now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. I'm Phil Lairness, and down under for, is it three more weeks? This is Mujahideen Dean Haglund.
Hi, everyone. Yes, three more weeks to go. Oh, the memories, the wistfulness, the melancholy, the packing. There's so much going on.
You just created a whole ad campaign for the movie about your final 3 weeks in Australia. So does that mean after today we'll have three more Australian shows?
Let's think this through. After today, that's then that one.
That would be the 24th of September, the 1st of October, and the 8th of October. Would those all be Australia shows?
They would all be Australian shows.
Wow.
Okay. And then, I know. And then maybe we double up when I get to Australia. Get to Los Angeles. We bank a couple.
Well, now
I love production meetings on the air.
Now we have veered into the production meeting range.
Fantastic.
So, Dean Haglund, how goes the Down Under bucket list?
Spectacular. Where are we at on that? The Hilarium, selling out the weekends. Performing at King's Cross. Holy smokes. Cannot
Your bucket list item for 3 weeks has been the Hilarium and stand-up, which is ostensibly stuff you do anywhere.
Well, that's true, isn't it? What was else on the bucket list?
So far you have scuba diving the Barrier Reef, you've done, and signing up for a tour of a bridge. That is what we've accomplished. And the weeks are whizzing by. Is there literally nothing else in Australia that you have yet to accomplish, visit, participate in, partake of?
I'm afraid that's kind of it. You see the bridge. Look at the Opera House. Maybe.
So,
if you want to see.
So pretty much your average tourist in a week in Australia manages to hit the full bucket list.
I like to say I'm kidding, but in fact, that's often what the tourists do here. They come in, see the bridge, do the Opera House, go out in the desert a bit, see the Barrier Reef, and get out of there. So, but yeah, you can do it all in a week.
The smart ones, the ones in the know, of course, are also hitting the Hilarium.
Yes, of course. Yeah, we did that for the locals, but the tourists are welcome as well.
All right. Hey, I want to revisit one of the emails we discussed last week.
What did we get wrong?
No,
what
it's not wrong. It's just it was such a packed email missive about casting and about how audiences are playing roles in the casting decisions now through their anger online, right? Of whether they think someone is wrong for a variety of reasons. And part of it had to do with obviously race, gender, sexual preference, and I talked about how, you know, we're in danger if the people responsible for telling the story don't get to cast the people that they think are right. We've witnessed when horrible miscastings have happened because people have gone ahead with projects when they should have known that someone was miscast, but probably that film got financed because of such and such a name being involved. And nobody cared whether it was going to work because, hey, we get to make a movie.
Yeah, but it's also historically, I mean, we look back perhaps at Orson Welles casting, how is that escaping me at the moment? The famous one where the Mexican...
Well, he didn't cast Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston cast him. Charlton Heston, movie got made because Charlton Heston was a huge box office star. This is so bizarre. How am I telling this same story on two different shows in 1 week for a movie that is 60 years old this year?
Well, anyway, because it's a cultural example of what we're talking about.
But the point was that Orson Welles had not been hired in Hollywood to direct anything since Lady from Shanghai. In 1948,
right.
He had not gotten a Hollywood gig, and he was hired to be a supporting actor just to play the sheriff. And Charlton Heston goes into the head of Universal's office and said, really, we got Welles to play the part. Put him on the speakerphone right now. I want to welcome him on board. And when your biggest box office star tells you to do something, you do it. And so they get Orson Welles on the speakerphone, and Charlton Heston says in front of the entire studio brass, I want you to know, Orson, what an honor it is to be starring in a movie that you will be writing and directing.
Yeah.
And Charlton Heston says, now I'll let you talk with the studio brass. And he leaves the room, leaving them to suddenly offer him the job of writing and directing the movie.
I did not know that story.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, see?
Yeah. So
that's how I'm going to do it.
And Heston is not miscast in terms of the dramatic qualities, the heroic qualities, the emotional qualities. He's not miscast. Why he is miscast in a contemporary contextual lens that you would like to think would have, been existing at that time.
Right.
Is that he's in brown face, right?
Right, yeah.
And
yeah, he's clearly not Latino, playing a Latino person.
And,
a character.
And I mean, I've seen film noirs. You know, I've talked about them on this show. What a great film noir lead Ricardo Montalban was. And
yes.
And he wasn't just playing characters that were written for Hispanic actors or Latino actors. He was playing a police detective in Boston, for crying out loud, because Ricardo Montalban was just a great actor and really believable as a film noir lead. So why not that guy? Right?
Right.
But... again, it's because it gets made because he's a movie star. All right. So flash forward, and thank God we live in a time where hopefully enough cultural pressure can be laid on so that such a thing doesn't happen anymore. That said, as I argued last week, the big problem was always that the door of opportunity didn't swing both ways. You could get away with Jonathan Pryce as the engineer, right, on stage in Miss Saigon if there were equal opportunities for Asian actors to be playing roles that were ostensibly written for quote-unquote white people, right? But the door of opportunity never swung both ways, and that was the problem. Interesting casting. Non-racial specific casting can be very interesting, but it really stops being interesting when you are the race that never gets to see yourself depicted accurately on screen, right?
Right.
Okay. So,
so.
As so much happens, though, and this is what I wanted to add kind of new to the mix this week, as happens so often culturally, when that pendulum starts to swing, it has a tendency to swing too far.
And overcorrect.
Overcorrect. We've seen this, I think, with Me Too and Time's Up, right? The zero tolerance that has tended to wash out to sea all manner of behavior without having a conversation that there are grades, there are measures.
Right.
There's
nuances.
Nuances, depending on context, right? Not all behavior is
right.
the same and deserves the same consequences. And so as the pendulum swinging, nuanced conversation becomes very, very difficult. And to a degree, you have to say, that's okay, because honestly, nobody seemed to want to have a nuanced discussion about this when the wrong thing was taking place for so many years.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So where does that leave us with casting? Well, I want to share a story, a funny story, I think.
No good.
About
okay.
a movie called Funny Story. And it's
okay.
a film by director Michael Gallagher that has been playing the festival circuit. It's a really, really nice independent film. It focuses on, I guess the basic story is about a man who's estranged from his daughter and wants to spend time with his grown daughter. And so he comes to visit her since she was going to be visiting him, but then says she can't because she's got to attend a function like in Big Sur on the weekend. So he decides, you know what? I'm going to go see her. And what he goes to see is her getting married. And not only her getting married, it turns out, but getting married to a woman. And
yeah.
And not only a woman, but a woman that this man himself has had a relationship with.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's okay. It's complicated.
Great.
And the gender politics
yeah.
are complicated. And it was really interesting hearing some of the questions. For example, people in the audience, first of all, thanking these people for making a film that did involve gay and queer storylines and characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then, before you knew it, these very people who are thanking them are also asking them, as straight white people, what makes you think you have anything to say about this? And the thing is that that's not a bad question. Hold somebody
right.
accountable. If you're an outsider, what is it that you think you're bringing that matters? And
right.
And be able to answer that question. I think questions that hold storytellers accountable for their decisions, right down to the decision of why did you make this, are not out of the pale. I think they're important questions. I think they lead to better storytelling, quite frankly.
Well, absolutely. And that question should be asked by the storyteller at the beginning in the first place.
Yes.
Why are you making this? If it's just for a paycheck, then don't make it.
Then we move into questions where they demand to know the sexual orientation of the actors who played the parts.
Hmm. Okay.
And at that moment, that sound you hear is the pendulum having swung too far. Because
yeah.
we do not want to live in a world. In fact, there are union rules that are supposed to be there to prevent people in casting, producers, directors, from asking actors questions like, how old are you? What's your mm-hmm. ethnicity? What's your sexual preference?
Orientation.
Sexual orientation.
Yes.
They are not allowed to ask these questions for good reason, because the idea is supposed to be, can this person play the part? And the moment you start qualifying them based on their personal life and background, you're not looking through an honest and open lens at what they are capable of believably playing. You are pre-qualifying
right.
them in a way we don't want people to be pre-qualified. And so, you know, the director was really, God bless him, he was really flabbergasted going, I didn't ask. I don't know. I have no idea the sexual preference of most of the people who worked, on this film or any of my films. Why would I?
Right.
It's not something I should ask. And it was leading into an awkward terrain, and it was actually Lily Holloman, who is in this film, who took over the Q&A at that moment. It was amazing. She had more lines in the Q&A at the Arclight than she does in the film itself. And she pointed out that she basically explained what the movie was about. And she explained about it in the matter of exploring the depth psychology of the characters being depicted, and said that these psychological patternings deep from our psyche are there regardless of our sexual orientation. And they are things that are accessible to all human beings. I'm not even doing justice to what she said, but the point is, you could hear a pin drop afterwards, because people either were right on board with what they said, or knew, because they didn't understand it at all, that it was so brilliant that they had better not say a fucking thing.
Wow. That's fantastic. I'm often faced by something so brilliant I don't say a fucking thing.
Anyway, which is really bad, because it's in the middle of your one-man improv shows.
That's right. I sometimes bedazzle myself with my own brilliance.
So I do think we're at a point where if we are pre-qualifying actors based on sexual orientation, then we're into a dangerous area, because we are now suddenly giving the people who hire actors permission to screen actors.
Right.
On that basis. So, and that's and we don't want them doing that, because that's what led us to this place in the first whole damn place.
Exactly. So it's got to be a course correction. And now this is always difficult to say course correction, because those who have been underserved by society for all this time see it as a veering away from a newfound freedom and revolution that's going on, which is not the case. But, you know, it has to happen organically, the course correction. You can't force any of this in any way, just as, you know, Me Too came organically, so too does it evolve organically.
I have become a little bit concerned. I don't want to throw any festivals under the bus here, but I have grown a little bit concerned that certain festivals that are gay and lesbian and queer and transgendered film festivals, as you know, I've participated in many of these festivals in the past, and many of them are quite successful, and they're among the best film festivals and the most fun film festivals you can attend, and they have served an important cultural need. And I have started to grow concerned that they haven't moved beyond focusing on films that are about people, let's say, being gay, versus being about people who happen to be gay. Because most films are not about straight people. They are populated by straight people or straight characters, right?
Right.
You know, most films have nothing to do with whether or not the characters you're following are heterosexual or homosexual. They're about blowing shit up, really.
Right. Exactly.
And it's almost always, straight people doing it. And if you're fortunate enough to have a character who may be gay within the film, it's the best friend, it's the comic relief, it's the sadistic villain, it's some kind of type, right?
And, right.
And I think where we want to get to is where we're telling human stories that are universal and that depict a wide variety of characters. We're at a point, obviously, still with different issues of gender identification, where we need stories about what that is like, because people have so many misconceptions about it. But I think we ought to be culturally at a time where we just have stories where, oh my God, the characters are gay, but it's not about them being gay. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I immediately think to Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Adam Sandler, where the police chief is a gay character, but it is kind of irrelevant to the comedy and the storyline. Occasionally it comes up, but it's never, you know, the thing. So,
and I say this because I'm worried that, for example, if, let's say I was to make a movie, I'm just spitballing, a detective movie where the main character, the detective, is gay.
Right.
It would not get into some of the major gay and lesbian film festivals because it's not about him being gay. It's about the mystery that he's solving.
Right.
And that that would really disappoint me. So anyway, that's my, I guess, is not really about what this person was saying about casting, but I think that is where we want to be heading, right? Where the great diversity of human experience within any culture is being reflected in the stories that that culture is telling and producing.
Yes. Yes. And then I'm going to still say, though, that I get that for so long those stories were repressed, and now there's a chance for that exploration and that voice to be heard. I don't know how long or how many generations that has to play itself out. Again, I'm talking about organic evolution. How do you put a timeline on that? When do you say, okay, we've had enough of that? You know, this brings to all those accused in the Me Too of when can they come back? You know, and it's like there's no answer to that.
Well, I think it is when we sense that the pendulum swung too far. And that's why I'm saying I think some worthy stories are being ignored by not even getting to find audiences that would enjoy them because the gatekeepers have politically decided that they are not enough something.
Right.
So
see, now anytime I hear gatekeepers, though, it's like, well, is there a gatekeeper?
Of course there is. Man. Of course there is. And we're talking about the film festival route, and there are huge gatekeepers.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I mean...
Yeah, yeah. In the film festival route, there is.
Yeah, they are entirely judging the success of, you know, their festivals through the milieu of what their agendas are. And often, it's how do the films that we show service the pre-existing distribution infrastructure. So... Anyway,
right.
Hey, we need to move on to celebrity deaths, Dean Haglund, especially because...
Oh, my gosh.
One is X-Files related.
Celebrity deaths.
Mulder's dad died, Dean.
Oh, yes. This came in through my ether.
That's how it happened?
How sad was that?
That's how it happened?
Yeah, that's how it happened. Somehow I just heard about it.
Your ether is responsible for Peter Donat dying at age 90. Born Collingwood Donat in Kentville, Nova Scotia. This guy was a groundbreaking Canadian actor.
Right.
He played a lead role in 1961 in Donald Jack's stage play, The Canvas Barricade, and that was the first Canadian play ever performed at the Stratford Festival.
Wow. I didn't know that.
That's a big deal. Big deal. In 65, he was cast as Vince Conway on Moment of Truth. Do you remember Moment of Truth, Dean Haglund?
No, I do not. Give me a hint.
The only Canadian serial, what Americans would often call soap operas, right? The only Canadian serial ever broadcast on a commercial television network in the U.S.
Wow. Boy, I am way, way behind on my Canadian television history here.
So,
the Moment of Truth, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that amazing? He comes from a celebrated acting family. Peter Donat's younger brother, Richard Donat, he stars currently on the television show Haven. And
right.
Their uncle is one of my all-time favorites, Robert Donat. Who was an Oscar winner for Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and who starred in Hitchcock's The 39 Steps.
Oh.
Remember how great that guy was? I mean...
Totally.
He, to me, was one of the really, maybe the best movie star in the 30s. And so believable in action and romance and comedy. And And again, like I said, an Oscar winner, and he doesn't have the kind of career you think he would have because he leaves the UK and instead of taking his big success and moving to Hollywood, he moves to Canada.
Right.
And so that's where the family ends up settling. But that is, so with the death of, you know, Mr. Donut yesterday, it's really, it's a chance to celebrate a really important movie family.
Yeah, the whole Donut clan.
His credits before, you know, or alongside the X-Files include basically guest starring in everything that you think of when you think of primetime television from the 60s through the 80s. I mean, Mission Impossible, Banachek, The Waltons, Hawaii Five-O, Mannix, Charlie's Angels, Lou Grant, Baba Black Sheep, Rich Man, wow. Poor Man, Quincy, Heart to Heart, Hill Street Blues, Simon and Simon, Murder, She wow. Wrote.
Holy smokes.
Movies. How about the Hindenburg? How about Fist? How about the China Syndrome? How about the War of the Roses? How about David Fincher's The Game?
Holy.
So, I mean, this guy, as I often say, the becoming a star is no small product of luck and good fortune, but to have worked for as many decades as this guy did, with as many heavy hitters as he did, in as many high-profile projects as he did, it's because of one reason and one reason alone. This guy knew his shit.
Yeah, right? Well, and that was often how they would cast at the old X-Files production office. You know, maybe I'm touching on something, but, you know, think of all the great stars, Devon Neville, I mean, Canadian actors, Canadian senior actors that have come through.
Lest I correct you too late that people accuse I'm looking it up on IMDb. You mean John Neville, but please
John
continue.
Neville. Yes. Yes. John Neville and I had a lovely chat before he died at one of the rap parties.
Star of Adventures of Baron Munchausen, for crying out loud.
I know. I think that's what we chatted about.
But did you ever, get to meet Mr. Donut, the actor who played Mulder's father?
Briefly at a party, but again, it was a short chat. We never had scenes together, and I had known him to be, you know, well-versed in the theater, and so other than that, we didn't chat that much, unfortunately. I regret it to this day.
He never got to come up on stage and recreate his role as the elder Mr. Mulder in a improv episode of The X-Files at any convention?
He never went. I don't think we were ever, I ever saw him at any of the X-File conventions. I'm pretty sure he didn't, he eschewed those, if I'm not mistaken.
All right. Well, a sad day for X-Files. As we celebrate the 25th anniversary, we celebrate the life of Mulder's dad, the late, great Peter Donut. We also didn't talk about this woman last week. Famous, I guess, by adjunct, but worthy of celebration. Brilliant in her own right. And that is Mary Willard, best known as the wife of four-time Emmy nominee Fred Willard, died at age 71. She actually died in July, but they held back news of her death from the public for some time. This is a woman who mentored and nurtured countless comedic writers and actors through the years, through the Willards' L.A.-based comedy sketch group, The Mohos.
And, right.
She directed all those shows, and she was a prolific television writer and playwright as well. Many of her plays were produced. And in addition to that, was tireless in terms of her philanthropy work for such organizations as PETA, Actors and Others for Animals, and was the president of Farrah's Angels, which is the Farrah Fawcett Foundation.
Oh, right.
So,
wow.
as you would kind of expect with someone married to Fred Willard, she was brilliantly funny, had a brilliant sense of humor. And what you would hope is for such a successful partnership, she balanced Fred's brilliant improvisational style with a writer's mind of, you know, who understood structure.
Right. Ugh. So sad. I didn't know this story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
So.
Well, that's a drag.
All right. Mary Willard. We also, talking about television comedy, did you see this,
okay,
this weekend that Bill Daly died?
Yes. From I Dream of Jeannie and the Newhart Show.
91 years old. And who doesn't love, I mean, if you don't love Bill Daly, it's because you didn't watch sitcoms in the 1970s.
That's right. That's right. His impeccable timing, that, how would the short staccato, how would you describe his delivery? It was always somewhat exasperated and king of the killer pause when you think of him and Bob Newhart. Just some of the silent moments that would just get laughs. Man, that was a brilliant, brilliant performer.
He played astronaut major Roger Healy in I Dream of Jeannie and next door neighbor Howard Borden in the Bob Newhart Show. And the thing was, is that he was so funny. I mean, you always knew, you loved when he just showed up on screen, because you already were laughing in anticipation of how much he was going to make you laugh. And it is the timing, it is the delivery, and it is always the fact that no matter how exasperated he would get, he's always good-natured and always decent.
Right. Yeah, there was never any, like, I'm trying to think of any angry, raging moment where he's flipping. I can't even think of it.
And so, he's always single, which means he's always kind of on the make, but he was never creepy. He always seemed so good-hearted.
That's true, right? How do you do that? Now that's something to pull off.
Yeah. Yeah. He's really, I mean, he was amazing. A little bit about, again, no matter how, and those are iconic shows, obviously. And,
of course.
But again, no matter how iconic the work somebody gets identified with, there's always, so much more about them and that just fascinating. And the one little thing I'll throw in about Bill Daly, in the 1980s, he served as New Mexico's film commissioner for the state.
I didn't know that.
No,
that's pretty cool.
Isn't that
cool?
Was
he living in New Mexico?
I would imagine. And I mean, how much does a guy love both his home state and the business? That's what I want to do. I want to do that. I'll do that. Yeah.
Right. And now you think of New Mexico as kind of a real happening film scene over there that probably took 20 years to develop. Probably no small thanks to Bill.
That's what I wonder. I wonder if there even was a film commission in New Mexico before him.
Probably not, right?
Yeah, why would anybody be filming there in the 70s?
Right. You wouldn't think of it until you needed a desert backdrop. But you would go to Nevada back then. So, well, see? The things you learn on this show.
All right, one more before we close up the Chill Pack morgue for another week. Mac Miller, 26 years old. So, you know, Mac Miller, you know, I didn't know. I mean, you're into rap.
I'm into rap as much as the next person is, unless that person's into it.
Yes, exactly. He had just released his fifth studio album entitled Swimming. Now, I'm always touched to realize that we're remembering the life of someone who was 15 when we started this podcast.
right.
I don't mean this episode. I mean,
yeah. So you did.
But he released his fifth album in August. It debuted at number 3 on the Billboard 200. When did Billboard 100 become the Billboard 200? I don't even know.
But when he doubled the number of musicians.
But that's for another, I guess, another day. The album featured the single Small Worlds, which is a big hit. He was about to start a U.S. tour in support of the album on October 27th in San Francisco. His 2016 album, The Divine Feminine, which I actually had heard of, charted at number 2 on the Billboard 200 and featured guest appearances from the likes of Kendrick Lamar, Anderson .Paak, and Ariana Grande. I have heard of those people.
Excellent.
And Mac Miller and Ariana Grande were in a long-term relationship. Now, this is what I love about the news reports. Get this. They were in a long-term relationship from 2016 until earlier this year.
That maybe is long-term. You know, maybe they had made a commitment.
Why not just write that they were in a long-term relationship for a short period of time?
Okay, again, semantics, I would think.
Yeah, I don't think they meant long-term. I think probably serious or committed relationship. But you don't get to call it long-term. The duration of the relationship is what determines whether it's long-term.
Not the commitment level.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, I get it. Yeah, okay.
Anyway, Miller's real name was Malcolm McCormick. He was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, January 19th, 1992. And that is your Celebrity Deaths for another week.
Celebrity Deaths.
You want to talk about some movies, Dean Haglund?
Well, I've been catching up on the old Netflix, some of the ones that I had realized I haven't seen, having just finished that dreadful Tom Hanks reenactment of the plane landing on the Hudson River.
Oh, Sully. You did not like Sully, huh? You're sullying the memory of that movie.
Well, I think the movie sullied the memory of that movie. I mean, you know, again, you're really digging deep as a writer to write the screenplay to find what, you know, what's the emotional arc? What is the through line of a guy who is, you know, lauded as a hero reluctantly? And, you know, to me, it was arched. I believe the term arched comes into play here.
I think you're ignoring so what do you think the movie's about? What would you say the movie's about? I have misgivings, but I have misgivings for an entirely different reason than you do. I think we saw two different movies. So what would you say the movie was about to someone who hadn't seen it?
Fantastic. I would say it is about the consternation of the fame and gaze of the public eye of a guy doing his job, basically. So, you know, it was portraying a, you know, down to earth pilot who did what he did. And then the NTSB boards grills him and does computer simulations saying he could have landed at the airport. And, you know, he walks out of the bar that's named a drink after him, like all of these things that he's having trouble dealing with, that it is more than he wishes he signed up to. That's what I think it's about.
Yeah. I would say that it is a story of a man who is a hero because he risks everything to stand up to a bureaucracy. In the name of professionals being allowed to do the jobs they're hired to do. And that his willingness to fight that and go through that is what makes him a hero in the eye of the movie. And that the movie is arguing about how much we need to get rid of these organizations, these bureaucracies, these restrictions, these regulations. It is an anti-regulatory, right-wing piece of propaganda.
Yeah, they're painting that safety board.
Made by one of the most famous Republicans in show business, Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, okay, but what I don't want is my airplane safety to be deregulated.
That's what we're getting at. See, you have a misgiving because you don't want them to have made that movie. I have a misgiving because they made it well.
Did they make it well?
I think it was well received. I think it was popular. I think the critics liked it. And I think they got away with coloring some people's views of this kind of regulation. And which is great. I mean, I both admire them and I wag my finger. I doff my cap and I wag my finger at it because I do think it's dangerous. I do think it's dangerous. But again, as a storyteller, I would then say I can't criticize the movie because it actually does what it's trying to do, I think, very, very well. And if you enjoy that movie, you come away from it going, yeah, stick it to the man. drain the swamp.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
because you're not an expert. We need the best people. Remember all that stuff Trump used to say? We're going to hire the best people. We don't need these bureaucrats telling us. We need the best people. And that's what the movie argues and shows. I mean, it's fascinating. I think you're dismissing the movie because of what it wanted to say. And again, I wish we could dismiss it because it was good at it. That's what makes it dangerous. If it was bad, I wouldn't have any problem with the movie.
Oh, right. Right. But the fact that you thought it was so good and the message so terrible.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
You know, interesting.
It would be like why, as we always talk about, oh, my goodness. I can't remember. I'm forgetting the name of the director of Rio Bravo. Howard Hawks.
Howard Hawks.
It's why Howard Hawks makes Rio Bravo after getting, he and John Wayne get incensed by High Noon.
Right. You know? Exactly.
They're not incensed because it's a bad movie. They're incensed because of the fact that it's a good movie. People are going to come away with altogether the wrong impression of what the character of America is.
Right.
So
exactly.
Anyway. Okay. Good.
There we go.
I saw a couple of older films. If we're going to talk about that,
let's do that.
One I hadn't seen since film school, and this was really interesting. It's both outdated in some ways because of the gender politics of it, but also more prescient than ever. And it was the Judy Holliday vehicle, the last time she collaborated with George Cukor. It was It Should Happen to You.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the movie where she becomes famous by renting out billboards and just putting her name and her image up on it.
Oh, is that right? Is that when that started?
Yeah, and that's where Angeline got the idea. And it's where, seriously, they even address it in the movie. Where does it end? And the era of celebrity. I mean, it all traces back to kind of this movie and what it's warning about. The movie's also fascinating for being, among other things, Jack Lemmon's first screen role.
Oh,
and
did not know that.
He'd been on Broadway a lot, and he was ready. When he got his break, he was ready. It's 6 short years from this to The Apartment. And in that time, of course, you've got everything from, Mr. Roberts' Bell, Book, and Candle, Some Like It Hot. But this guy came out of the gates ready. And it's a different time, isn't it? It's a different time. You might find somebody who's great in a film, but that doesn't mean they're ready for the opportunities that are then going to come their way.
So true.
The other thing that I love is they do some fantastic on-location shooting, although it's so confusing to me about why Hitchcock would do this in the 50s too. But here's Cukor doing amazing on-location Central Park filming, entire walk-in talks with Jack Lemmon and Judy Holliday. And these people were big on stage. They could do this stuff, right? And then all of a sudden they stop and we cut into a close-up And the close-ups are quite obviously done on a soundstage in front of a green screen. And then we cut back to the two shot, and now we're back in Central Park. And it's not only disturbing from a standpoint of the visuals not quite matching, but also the performance is not quite matching. And how could they? It's like, okay, now we're going to go back in months later and shoot your close-ups.
In a studio, could you reenact how it was in that park on the fall day?
So that's,
it's a totally different feel.
That's bizarre. But I think I've mentioned this once before, maybe on the show, maybe more than once. But one of the things about the golden age studio system that I loved about actors being under contract and learning their craft, right? You would be paid each week, whether you were in a movie or not, and you were being paid to go to classes, to take a wide variety of classes, elocution, dance, writing, skills, but also acting and scene study and character work. And
fencing.
And as you graduated, you were then put into what we call background work, extra work. Before you ever were given a couple lines here and there, you would be an uncredited background player. And the thing is, those movies, it is so refreshing to see crowd scenes or to see public scenes because you believe them. And the reason you believe them is because everyone in the background is playing an actual character. You don't see anyone walking from point A to point B because an assistant director told them to. There are relationships on screen. So I'm sitting here watching this opening scene in Central Park, obviously filmed on location, and I am believing everything I am seeing, and which has me asking myself, so are these studio-trained actors that they have brought in to be extras, or were they filming quasi-documentary style? Because it's one,
fantastic question.
It's one or the other. And all of a sudden, this confrontation takes place between Judy Holliday and a man in the park, and some of the extras gather around to witness it, and there is a teenaged John Saxon standing in the front row of onlookers. I recognize my old friend. And even when he was a boy, I can recognize him, and I get my answer. These are actors under contract.
Actors.
And
isn't that something?
And so we talk about supporting actors. We celebrate supporting actors because what are they supporting, Dean? They're supporting our belief in the world we're watching. We will follow lead actors if they are, and actresses, if they are attractive, if they are interesting, if they are funny, if they are in some way heroic, whatever it is that we like about them. But we only believe the world we're watching if we believe the supporting players. That's what they're supporting.
Right.
And that support extends to the quote-unquote background performers as well.
Isn't that fascinating? Because nowadays, you know, that is almost an afterthought. We just need bodies back there. They're going to be out of focus. We won't need them to even, you know, have makeup on half the time. So I am now dying to go back to see other crowd shots in early 50s, 60s studio time. To see other burgeoning actors that I can identify.
Even though this movie, like I said, doesn't stand the test of time because of the gender politics. I mean, the stuff with Peter Lawford is just awful. The idea that Judy Holliday's dreams are wrong because she should want to be a certain kind of woman. I mean, it's still a fairly conservative film in that regard. But at the same time, it's a delight because Judy Holliday was every bit the comedic genius on the big screen that Lucille Ball was on the small screen. And truly, the word genius applies, right? I mean, Born Yesterday, she wins an Oscar for, and truly a genius because she, that old adage, right, that you have to be really smart to play someone really dumb. You know, she was one of these, she had a Mensa IQ, and she was famously kind of this ditzy person who wanted to better herself. That was kind of the character that she got to play, which was common to Lucille Ball. Was there ever a more shrewd, smart cookie than Lucille Ball in real life? But when you think about I Love Lucy, she always wants to be smarter than she is, right? Isn't that the
right
element?
Well, exactly. It's always a kind of a scheme she's got that backfires in her face.
Now, the other old one that I saw, and I bring up largely because it also is about a female performer from a decade earlier who had a big run, and that was Veronica Lake. She was a really big star and is remembered, I think, for a lot of her sultry femme fatale work. But what I was astonished by, first in rewatching Sullivan's Travels, and then in watching I Married a Witch, the Renee Clair movie from 42 starring Frederick March. Veronica Lake was the most adorable comedic actress. And
she had comedy chops, that's for sure.
Oh my God, if she hadn't been so long-legged and hot that she had to play the femme fatale roles, why couldn't she have had a long-lasting comedy career?
And I think nowadays you probably could have, she could have, because we, you know, have more space for the comedic on that. But yeah, and of course that haircut too, right? The blonde locks covering one eye was iconographic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But boy, what a little snickerdoodle she was, quite frankly.
That's adorable.
And I tell you, I watched it because in this household, quite a few marriage-themed movies are being watched to get production design ideas for a certain wedding in February.
Oh, my God. Oh, no. We're doing production design?
It's not just the freezing of the frame to stare at the production design, but the taking of photos of our television set.
Oh, no. To show to who?
Yeah, the team. I guess there's going to be a team.
Oh, that's a team. Right.
Hey, a couple of more recent movies. One that's just out onto home video and digital was released theatrically beginning of this summer. Independent film reteaming, I think for the fourth time, screenwriter Diablo Cody with director Jason Reitman. Of course, previously they'd done Young Adult and probably most famously Juno, the Oscar-winning Juno.
Right.
But it also reteams them with their young adult star, Charlize Theron. And it's a movie called Tully. And we're split in this household. Lily loved this, thought it was such a wonderfully honest depiction of what motherhood is like, what people... And I'll be honest, it's the kind of depiction of motherhood that the male-dominated film and television industry, again, the gatekeepers, would rarely let get through.
No.
And it's about postpartum depression. It is it's a messy, messy movie about the reality of it and the psychological challenges that mothers face, right? And
right.
But so she loved it, and I will describe it this way.
Yeah.
in 90 minutes, this is going to sound like a joke, and yet this is so specific. If you know these movies, this is so specific to truly what it is. This movie is, in 90 minutes, The Fight Club meets A Woman Under the Influence.
Wow. That's terrible.
If
or
you
is
think,
it?
Whatever you think of when you first think of Fight Club.
Right.
Yep. That's in Tully.
Good Lord. Really?
And A Woman Under the Influence, which is, I think, to this day, the most truthful, honest depiction of you know, what motherhood can be from the point of view of the other members of the family. Because so often addiction and mental problems are they manage to be camouflaged and kept hidden, right? You're not there when the things are happening. And as we've talked about with other movies that have tried to kind of, they rub our faces in the reality of what's going on when you're not around. There's something really extra potent about being forced to be in the position of this family and only getting to see what they get to see and how it tears a family apart. And that's Cassavetes' Woman Under the Influence, which I think is his best film. And but anyway, so
this Tully thing sounds terrible.
Yeah, spoken like two men. We are
right.
So yeah, I mean, I love you know. Immediately, Lily hit me with the "You're supposed to be feminist."
So,
yeah.
Which means you're supposed to enjoy.
Part of it is also that, I mean, it did trigger a migraine in me, this movie. 34 minutes in, I had such a migraine.
No.
And part of it is because of the just the milquetoast men in her life. Not just the characters, but the milquetoast actors playing them.
Oh, no.
In fact, I have enjoyed movies with Mark Duplass before, but please, if you're making an independent film and a character lends itself towards being milquetoast, can you please not cast Mark Duplass?
There's got to be someone else.
All right.
Of all the actors out there.
Yeah, cast against type. Gosh. How many times can we hit that nail on that particular head?
Oh, with apologies to Mark.
In this case, it was my head, and the hammer was hitting me over and over and over again.
No,
all right,
oh my
finally,
gosh.
A movie that you have to see, Dean Haglund.
Excellent.
I kind of believe everybody needs to see it. This is from director Anish Chaganti. It's his first film. It's from producer Timur Bekmambetov, who years ago made a real splash with a Russian movie he had directed called Night Watch. But he's been far more acclaimed as a producer in this country.
Mm.
Because, quite frankly, the movies he's directed here have been schlock. But the schlock movies he's produced have been well-produced.
Spectacular.
And successful. And they make quite a team in a film that features a career-making performance for, let's not kid ourselves, the quite beloved John Cho. John Cho has such a following and such affection for, and I don't mean this dismissively, but for often being the best thing in mediocre movies or the thing that most recommends the things that he's in, right? I mean... and it's nice to see him in something, and this isn't the first time, but of late he's been given the opportunity to do more than try to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. And it started last year with Columbus, which made a lot of top 10 lists, and this year a thriller called Searching that is going to top a lot of people's lists. Have you heard about this film, Dean?
I have not. I've not heard a thing about this.
Okay. It has surprised people by doing really big box office. Let me explain to you. I had heard this and didn't believe it could be true and didn't want it to be true. And as I sat down in the movie theater and sunk down into my seat and realized that I had turned off all my computer screens and all my backlit screens and decided to take a break by walking through the village and going to the movies in order that I could stare at backlit screens for 2 hours, I was a little bit annoyed because this is a movie that takes place not mostly, not metaphorically, this movie takes place entirely on backlit screens, on computer screens, on cell phones, on security cameras and footage, on Snapchat. The entire movie is told through social media apps.
Ooh, that's cool.
You say it's cool. I'm the kind of guy that's going to be really annoyed by that because I'm in a movie theater. But I held out hope that this wouldn't just be a clever way to tell a story, that the story itself would be interesting because, you know, I'm on that lookout. Okay, you found an interesting way to tell a story, but is the story itself interesting? And about 20 minutes in, I had to acknowledge this is an interesting story. And I already was on the awareness of something thematically brewing through their technique, which is namely that we live at a time when altogether too many young people's lives are being lived predominantly through social media.
Not just social media, through a mediated experience of reality.
Yes.
That your reality is one step away. Social or otherwise, that your everything is on flat screen, two-dimensional. Even if you're wearing a 3D helmet, it's two-dimensional, but it's mimicking a reality that you could be experiencing.
And so this is about a widowed father who whose daughter, high school daughter, goes missing. And in the effort to track her down, he learns a lot about her and realizes she had already gone missing into these mediated platforms before she ever physically went missing. It is a great mystery, told in a wonderful style and technique, masterly revealed. Whether the twist works for you or not, maybe it goes a little too far, maybe it gilds the lily on its twists, but even then, it's a movie that demands repeated viewing, and here's what I love, Dean. All the media platforms that are shown are real. If we are watching the live web feed of KGO Channel 7 in San Francisco, it's really KGO Channel 7 in San Francisco. If we are on Facebook, it's not called Smacefook. It's really Facebook. It's really Snapchat. All the partners are real, but all the content was made exclusively for the movie. So what they thought they were doing was making a movie that would be so much easier to produce because we don't have to film long scenes with actors on locations. But in reality, they had to make 25 full movies because they had to populate all these screens all the time with made-up things. But as a result, I became aware of it the first time I'm watching it. There are entire storylines playing out that that you can follow if you read the other windows that are open on screens. If
oh, you're
you
kidding.
Watch the ads, if you follow them. There are, like, I mentioned to somebody who loves this movie how one of my favorite things was about the relationship, the romantic relationship that John Cho's character finds himself in. And the person who saw it, who loved it, said, but he's a widow. And I said, yeah, but he's dating someone. I said, I never saw him dating someone. And there's the thing. But I read several emails and text messages from this woman in the movie. So I knew what was going on. I knew how she was busting his balls about him not getting back to her. And then all of a sudden, the news breaks about his daughter being missing. And suddenly in all caps, oh, my God, I just heard about your daughter. I'm so sorry. What a crazy woman I must seem like. So maybe we see each other next week. And there is no shortage of this. There are so many storylines you can follow through this depiction of the main storyline.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
So is it in theatrical release right now?
It's in theatrical release right now. It is doing surprisingly big box office. A $1 million film that I think has already made something like $10 million. In its first weekend of theatrical release, it made $6 million. And
holy smokes.
So it's quite the film. Dean Haglund, you need to see it. If it's not available in Australia, I'm sure it will be on screen here in Los Angeles 3.5 weeks from now. And you kind of got to see it.
And it's one of those.
And then maybe we'll talk about it, because I think in no small way, honestly, these alternative approaches to telling stories owe no small element of thanks to a certain show called The X-Files.
Well, I don't want to take credit for all of culture, but okay.
Anyway, everybody, if you haven't done it, go see Searching. It's really a fascinating movie and enjoyable on so many levels. And again, like I said, how great to see John Cho, who has been such a loved performer for so long now. Suddenly get a big breakout thing that might put him in another realm.
Yeah, I can't wait.
All right. Well, that brings us to an end of another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can download and stream every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
Yeah, you can write us. You can write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Right.
We do hashtag
right? We give good hashtag. Like us on Facebook, won't you?
please like us. We'd like to be liked.
Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. I think that's it, Dean.
I think so. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Well, then, until next week.
Let's do this again next week.
Great.
Till then, I'm Dean Haglund.
And I'm Phil Lernis. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.